Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute, Center for Science and Culture. And we have on the show with us again today, Dr. Anne Gager, Senior Research Scientist at the Biologic Institute, discussing her new paper with Doug Axe, The Evolutionary Accessibility of New Enzyme Functions, a Case Study from the Biotin Pathway. And in the last podcast, we talked with Dr. Gager about her experimental work on the Cable and BioF enzymes, which showed that a minimum of 7 mutations would be necessary to convert an enzyme like Cable into an enzyme that is highly similar at the structural level like BioF. And for some ID the Future listeners who recall a paper that we discussed with Dr. Douglas Axe recently that he published, he looked at essentially the maximum number of neutral mutations that could take place in a population of evolving bacteria. And this is the maximum number that could take place over the course of the history of the Earth, granting all of the maximum favorable assumptions to Darwinian evolution. The most you could get is 6 neutral mutations, 6 mutations. Essentially, if you have a feature that requires 6 or more mutations before there's any function, that feature is not going to arise in the history of the Earth. So just converting this one enzyme, Cable, into BioF, a structurally very similar enzyme, required at least a minimum of 7 mutations at the DNA level, and that would seem to be above essentially the maximum number of neutral, non-adaptive mutations that could take place. So can you add, so our listeners can understand, why your results are so significant?
Well, there are a couple of things to keep in mind. Why some people would say, okay, why is it so hard to get 7 mutations? Well, first of all, you have to get 7 specific mutations, not just any 7. Second, none of these mutations by themselves confer any benefit to the organism until all 7 are achieved. So you got to wander through sequence space, hitting on the right mutations without any way of guaranteeing that the mutations are going to be preserved in the population as they accumulate. It tends to be the case that bacteria easily duplicate their genes, but they just as easily remove extra DNA. So if you have a gene duplicate that arises and then starts to accumulate mutations, the chances are, because it costs the bacteria to maintain extra DNA, the chances are that duplicate is going to be lost. Doug did his population genetics models under several different scenarios. One is, if it's free for carrying the extra DNA, that's the non-selective scenario where there's no fitness cost. That's where the number 6 comes from. But a more realistic scenario where it actually costs energy and therefore has a fitness cost for the cells to carry useless DNA, that brings the number down to 2 or 3 that are within reach of natural selection. That's one explanation for why it's so hard to get 6 or 7. A recent study published in 2010 looked carefully at the actual rate at which gene duplications and gene losses occur in bacterial populations. They did a very careful job, and they found out that, as I said before, duplications happen fairly frequently. 1 in 1,000 cells carries a duplicate on average. But they also lose the extra DNA at a very high rate. And the surprising thing was how much of a fitness cost it is for a cell to carry a chunk of its DNA duplicated. So we plugged those numbers into Doug's equation, the values obtained by this other research group, and the situation is actually much worse than Doug originally described in his paper. We calculate that in order for a bacterial population worldwide scope to achieve 7 mutations, it would take 10 to the 30 generations. And estimating about 1,000 generations per year, you get the idea that that's many billions more than the age of the Earth.
The age of the Earth is 10 to the 9th to 10 to the 10th years. So if you need, say, 10 to the 27th years to get 10 to the 30th generations, you're going to run a little short on time by somewhere in the order of about 10 to the 17th years. So obviously, the problem here is for Darwinian evolution, and it does seem pretty insurmountable. That means that it would require about 7 million times more years than we have available in the age of the universe simply to get this very modest number of 7 neutral mutations. So, Dr. Gager, I think that maybe this is becoming clear to our listeners, but I'd really like for you to discuss the general implications of your study sort of as a disproof of concept for the evolutionary model that gene duplicates can evolve new functions through sort of neutral evolution.
Well, the first thing it suggests is that similarity of structure or sequence does not imply ease of conversion. All of the evolutionary trees are based on similarities of one kind or another, sequence similarity, structural similarity, and the underlying assumption is that if two things look alike, they must be related by common descent. Ease of conversion is implied. And yet, our results say that even very closely related enzymes that should be among the easiest to convert, we couldn't accomplish within the reach of natural processes. Now, there's one other implication, and I didn't mention this before. When we converted those groups in the active site of cable to look like BioF, we essentially converted the entire active site of cable to look like BioF. The whole business end of the enzyme, where the chemistry is carried out, resembled BioF in sequence. That wasn't sufficient to convert it. So it implies something about the way proteins operate as well. It's not enough just to copy and paste active sites onto scaffolds. There's an interaction between the scaffold, the holding, the structural part of the enzyme that holds the active site into the right position that goes layers deep. You can't just cut and paste enzyme pieces together and expect them to get to work. This is not really a surprise. A lot of biologists, I think, understand it. Protein engineers certainly do. Proteins are highly complex structures. They have interacting networks of hydrogen bonds and salt bridges and other kinds of interactions that stabilize their fold. They have undergo structural changes when they bind their substrates. There has to be plasticity to the way the enzyme works in order for it to make those kinds of changes, in order for it to carry out its chemistry. And some enzymes are much more complex than others. The PLP-dependent enzymes that we study happen to be among the more complex. They have to recognize more than one substrate. They have to bind and transfer groups to more than one substrate. All of that makes the enzyme more complex than, say, a simple hydrolysis, you know, chopping a bond. Yet, if we're going to account for what we see in life, it has to be the case that these kinds of conversions can happen. Biologists understand that it's hard to convert enzymes. They understand that, and here's the way it shows up in the literature. They say things like, well, you have to start from the right starting place. You have to know what the ancestral sequence was. If you don't start from the right starting place, you're going to end up running into dead ends. You're going to end up having interactions that prevent you traversing a pathway leading to the new function. But my question is this. If it's so hard to convert one enzyme to another that you have to start from exactly the right spot, the right ancestral sequence, then what does that say about the history of evolution on Earth? It says that we've been extremely lucky thousands and thousands and thousands of times. We've managed to arrive at the chemistries we have by having just fortuitously the right ancestral proteins to allow these conversions to happen. That means that the fine-tuning of life is even more improbable than the fine-tuning of the laws of physics because you've got so much going on. Yeah. And you have to have some way of explaining how it is that these conversions happen. If they can't happen by a strictly Darwinian process where there are random mutations that are weeded out by natural selection, then perhaps it argues that instead these conversions happened by a guided process. I'm not saying they didn't happen at all. I'm not saying that BioF and cable aren't descended from a common ancestor. I'm saying that in order for it to have happened successfully, there had to be some intelligent agency behind it.
So essentially, your study is sort of a disproof of concept of the idea that you can just take enzyme A and take enzyme B, which is structurally similar, and evolve one to the other. Your study shows that it just requires more mutations than are available in the history of the Earth. And if you are going to be able to accomplish that transformation, It's going to be because you just happen to be at that very lucky starting point, in which case you have to ask the question, are we really dealing with, you know, a random, undirected type of Darwinian evolution or something else? So I think this is very interesting. So, Dr. Gager, are there other labs and studies that have corroborated the sort of conclusions that you guys came up with in your study?
Protein engineers whose goal it often is to create a new enzyme with a new function have been working at this problem for years. And they're coming to the realization that it's much harder to do than they thought it would be from the beginning. A recent paper published last year by Girlton Babbitt goes so far as to say, we thought it would be easy. If nature can do it, why can't we? And yet, there have been many studies where they try to convert an enzyme to a new function, a new chemistry, and they find it's very hard to do. My survey of the literature says that to get a genuinely new chemistry, not just to modify substrate preferences or to enhance an already existing chemistry, it takes 7, 8, 9, 20 mutations. And that is pretty common in the literature. There are very few cases where a single base change converts an enzyme to a new function. And even when it does, it's a very weak level of function. It makes us wonder whether it would be beneficial at all to the cell at that low, low level of activity. So very few transitions can be accomplished with one or two base changes, at least so far. So it's a challenge for protein engineers and evolutionary biologists to demonstrate that these conversions are easy. If they can demonstrate that our study is the exception, then they will have answered the question. But so far, the evidence in the literature suggests that these kinds of conversions are actually very hard.
Well, Dr. Gager, it's really exciting to see the kind of ID research that's going on. This is definitely just honing in on the exact kinds of questions that ID proponents want to address, which is, how do complex and specified enzymes become generated? How difficult is it to produce the specification in an amino acid sequence necessary to perform some biochemical function? I think these are the exact kinds of questions that go back to the earliest days of ID thinking, and you guys are now testing these kinds of questions experimentally. So I just want to congratulate you on your paper, and thank you very much for the work that you're doing.
Thanks, Casey.
Well, I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future. Don't let anybody, including Lori Lebo, tell you that there's no such thing as ID research. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.
Want to spend your summer studying intelligent design in Seattle for free? Discovery Institute is raising up the next generation of scientists and scholars with the 2011 summer seminars for college juniors, seniors, and graduate students. The two intensive 9-day learning opportunities run from July 8th through 16th. This year, in addition to the seminar focusing on ID and the natural sciences, the Center for Science and Culture announces the new C.S. Lewis Fellows Program on Science and Society, which will explore the growing impact of science on politics, economics, social policy, bioethics, theology, and the arts. Discovery Institute will pay expenses for students who are accepted into the programs, and applications are open now through April 22, 2011. For more information, visit www.discovery.org/STEM. That's www.discovery.org/SEM.